From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And this week, our topic is reality revised. A little more than a week ago, a heavy libel was lifted from Liverpool.
When I'm traveling around the country or visiting different parts of the country, I don't have to defend my city no more because now everyone knows what the truth is. I don't feel like I need to defend where they come from.
The 96 Justice. Family of the 96 gathered outside a local Anglican cathedral. On April 15th, 1989, 96 soccer fans were crushed to death when crowding into standing room terraces at Hillsborough Stadium. A government investigation, long pushed by the bereaved families, found that the stunningly incompetent local authorities were responsible and that the police had altered documents.
As those in power and authority began the culture of cover-up and lies,
and fed the press stories smearing the fans. Most notoriously, the Sun tabloid ran the headline, "The Truth, Some Fans Picked the Pockets of Victims, Some Fans Urinated on the Brave Cops." Last week, the Sun's current editor sincerely apologized. The editor responsible for that headline in 1989, Kelvin McKenzie, also apologized, but he's not much believed because of the defensive crouch he took as suspicions mounted last year.
That story came from a Liverpool news agency and Liverpool journalist.
This weekend, the Liverpool and Manchester United soccer teams are releasing 96 red balloons before their match to commemorate the dead, twice victimized, first by the event and then by the demeaning coverage. Often, the authorities are the source of the lies that ruin lives and mock the dead, as in Katrina.
One of the most volatile scenes in all of New Orleans today was at the convention center.
Police say there have been rapes and beatings, and now people are dying.
Some are destroyed by smears, the so-called Olympic bomber in Atlanta.
For nearly 3 months, he lived with the agony that the world assumed he was guilty until the FBI cleared his name.
After 88 days of hell, it's hard to believe that it is really over. Anybody who knew me understood that I could never hurt another person.
The mysterious Mr. Z, wrongly implicated in the post-9/11 anthrax attacks.
I am not the anthrax killer. I know nothing about the anthrax attacks. I had absolutely nothing to do with this terrible crime.
And possibly Jeffrey McDonald.
They can't take away the rest of my life and brand me as a murderer. I'm not.
Made famous in a book and miniseries for murdering his wife and daughters on a military base, and whose case is being reconsidered this week. We'll talk about that. But first, let's consider the lessons that could be learned by the coverage of last week's big media story. This.
The U.S. ambassador to Libya, our ambassador, has been killed along with three other Americans after a series of attacks by protesters.
Early in Egypt, demonstrators stormed the U.S. embassy in Cairo. Those attacks were triggered by a movie that denounces Islam.
The anger against the U.S. stemming from this amateur online film produced in America that has offended millions of Muslims.
The early coverage of those riots, ostensibly incited by a film called Innocence of Muslims, offered bits and pieces about its producer.
An American-Israeli filmmaker living in California.
According to reports published in the Wall Street Journal and the Associated Press, the filmmaker is a real estate developer from California named Sam Basile,
who said he intended the film to be provocative and said Islam is a cancer.
We also heard that Sam Basile's $5 million feature film, 14 minutes of which were uploaded onto YouTube and translated into Arabic, was funded by, quote, more than 100 Jewish donors. But as the week went on and protests spread across the Muslim world, questions emerged about the filmmaker.
The reaction to the film is worldwide news, but its making remains shrouded in mystery. The filmmaker claims to be Sam Basile.
Now in hiding for fear of his life, but Sam Basile is a dead end. No public records at all, apparently a fake name.
The film itself also appeared to have been faked when it became evident that the references to Islam and the Prophet Muhammad were sloppily overdubbed in post-production. And actors involved in the project emerged to say that they had no idea that they'd been working on an anti-Muslim film. The low production values led many to question the alleged $5 million budget. And so far, no one can be found who has actually seen the entire movie. Eventually, the man who claimed to be Sam Basile was exposed.
Police and reporters surrounded the Los Angeles home today of the twice-convicted felon who authorities tell ABC News was the writer, director, and financier of the controversial film.
An ex-con, an ultra-conservative Coptic Christian named Nakula Bessely Nakula, was escorted from his home to voluntarily answer questions about his role in the video.
One thing that is now clear, Sam Basile, a name that surfaced early in the reporting, is a fake.
Devin Harner blogs for PBS's MediaShift.org, where he wrote that major media organizations like the AP and Wall Street Journal were bamboozled by Sam Basile, but they shouldn't have been, because a number of details in the initial reporting just didn't pass muster.
Sam Basile self-identifying as an Israeli-American, the $5 million budget, and the quotes for me were problematic. My BS detector went off.
Apparently, it was the line, Islam is a cancer, which set those alarms ringing.
That feels like some kind of line from the 80s Cold War era movies. They're just venomous. And I thought to myself, who in their right mind would own up to this? And are they credible?
What did AP and the Wall Street Journal, which you single out, do wrong in this situation? Weren't they just reporting on the information as it came in?
I tried to get the AP reporter to comment, and she wouldn't speak to me, so I really don't know. But my best guess that they got turned on to this source by someone promoting the film, and the source just fed them this information that contributed to a latently anti-Semitic narrative that was perpetuated. So the reporter reported the facts as she heard the facts. But as I teach my introductory journalism students, if somebody tells you a line of BS and you report that BS, you're liable as well.
There was a skeptical report that still recounted most of the information, quote, known at the time on the NPR blog, that included the sentence, the bottom line is that we know very little about Sam Basile. And you took exception to the use of the royal we.
When I click on that link and I realize that we don't really know much, then I think to myself, well, what's the purpose of this link? There's kind of this collective mindset on the part of reporters to say something. And I think that a deep breath, a moment to figure out if we know anything before we write would benefit everybody.
You wrote that the unmasking of Basile became a news event in its own right, but that the mainstream media were collectively unable to admit that they'd been played.
This is a part of a bigger problem, the culture of breaking news reporting, where an update comes out, and this is what we know now. The implication is that this supersedes what we knew then. But can you go to every person who read that first story and take away the erroneous facts that Sam Basile was Israeli-American, that there were 100 Jewish donors, and that the budget was $5 million? It's a whole different world than it was in the old days of correction and retraction. A lot of times, I'm sitting at my computer at 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm on Google News. I'm after fact. I want something new. I put myself in the shoes of all these people at their computers late at night searching for news and wanting to find some kind of truth. And I think to myself that they deserve better than this.
What they deserve that's better is that reporters who have no good information should just shut up.
Not shut up, but find some good information. I when I was a kid, I was really into the band Talking Heads, and they had a song called Psycho Killer, and one of the verses was, you're talking a lot, but you're not saying anything. That's the kind of lyric that should be on your mind as a journalist. Am I adding anything here to the discourse? Exactly. There's no news there. It's what he's doing because he doesn't have another verse. think about the potential for these stories that are misreported to snowball via the internet.
You end your piece asserting that journalists who are constantly being asked to prove their worth aren't much helping their situation.
It's tough being a journalist in the digital age. You really don't get paid to be quiet. Once they figured out they've been played, the reporters circled back around and they found out who this guy was. And in the updated story, there's this beautiful little vignette where they go to this guy's house and they say, "Are you Sam Bassel?" He says, no, I'm not. And they say, "Let me see your driver's license." And he shows the driver's license with his thumb over his middle name, which is suspiciously like Basile. So this is the updated story after they got it wrong. And it's beautiful. What I would have liked to have seen was Sam Basile spoken to by phone, gives out this information. And the BS detector goes off. And then they start doing the kind of thing. "Let me see your driver's license. Can you name some of your investors? And why on earth would you take responsibility for this film, knowing what happened to Rushdie with the Satanic Verses and knowing what happened to Theo van Gogh?" That's the kind of stuff that they should have done before they broke it. But I think that the trouble was they wanted the scoop and they wanted the hits. Who was Sam Basile? That's a beautiful story to break if you actually know who he is. So they put the cart before the horse a little. There was good reporting. It was after the bad reporting.
Devin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Devin Harner teaches journalism and literature at the City University of New York and blogs for PBS's MediaShift.org. Coming up, is every fact created equal, or are some stories too good to check? This is On the Media.
You start a conversation, you can't even finish it. You're talking a lot, but you're not saying anything. When I have nothing to say, my lips are sealed.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. And the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence. At thescanfoundation.org. This is NPR. On the Media is supported by Audible.com, a provider of digital audiobooks and more, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. Audible selection includes Isaac Asimov's The End of Eternity, Dean Kuntz's Audapocalypse, or any of the Dresden Files series by Jim Boother. To learn more about Audible and get a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/onthemedia.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Craig Silverman, whose blog Regret the Error tracks journalism's mistakes, says a bad moon's rising.
So we're coming off what was, I call, the summer of sin.
CNN and Fox News initially reported, wrongly, that the Supreme Court had struck down the individual mandate in the Affordable Care Act. ABC News reporter Brian Ross implied, wrongly, that the Aurora, Colorado shooter James Holmes was a member of the local Tea Party. Interns at NPR and the Wall Street Journal were caught respectively plagiarizing and fabricating. CNN host and Time Magazine editor Fareed Zakaria confessed to plagiarizing. New Yorker and Wired.com writer and best-selling author Jonah Lehrer was caught recycling his own stuff. Is that so bad? And fabricating. That's bad. And the New Canaan News, a small Hearst paper in Connecticut, according to Silverman, employed, quote, one of the worst serial fabricators in modern journalism.
So a really, really bad summer. And yet when journalists at these news organizations, people in leadership roles, were sort of asked to say, well, what's going on and what are you looking into and what do you know as of this point? In a lot of cases, they actually wouldn't answer any questions.
You think it's hypocritical?
It is. If we make it a practice to stonewall requests for basic information about a transgression that's happened, then when we turn around and we do the exact same thing to government agencies or to large institutions in society or companies, they can say, well, you didn't answer questions from fellow journalists when something happened in your house. Why would I tell you about what's going on in our house?
That lesson isn't lost on Ira Glass. When this American Life's famous episode about Mike Daisy's trip to an Apple factory in China, concluding with an indictment of the company, turned out to be largely fabricated, Glass produced another episode anatomizing the errors and the process and agonizing over the breach of the listener's trust. That's why we're talking to him again this week. Actually, for the third week in a row, he's sort of becoming our Andy Rooney.
Brooke, have you ever thought about fact checkers? I mean, I've really thought about it.
But the potential fallout from the Daisy episode was no joke.
I mean, my fear was that people were going to ask, well, what about everything else you've ever put on the radio? I feel like we can't let this happen again as a staff. We can go to our audience once and say, like, oh, we messed this one up, but we cannot go to them a second time. So now we're spending between $300 and $1,000 a show on fact checkers. We set aside $60,000 in this year's budget to hire freelance fact checkers, people who work for, you know, national magazines and the New York Times magazine. And I want the stories to be right.
Different media outlets handle checking in different ways. On our show, we scrupulously research our guests, prep ourselves, and even fact check during the interviews. We're not live, so we can do that. We still make lots of mistakes, so we have a link to corrections and where listeners can report errors on our homepage. And we notate the transcripts to reflect the original error and the fix. NPR's All Things Considered produces up to 10 interviews a day. That's a lot of vetting, prepping, and post-interview follow-up. And so, says executive producer Chris Turpin, correct they must.
And it's why we took to running letter segments pretty much every day, which we didn't used to do. We are the first draft of history. We shouldn't pretend that we don't get things wrong on a regular basis. We have to work fast. We try very, very hard to get it right. But yeah, of course we should fess up when we don't get stuff right. We shouldn't be mealy-mouthed about it.
Has the operation changed at all in this fact-fraught season? When it seems everyone claims entitlement to their own facts, has there been a tweaking of the process?
I'm not sure entirely how you can tweak the process. Many people, particularly in the political realm, don't believe that they have to actually have any connection to the facts. You know, as you say, that creates a kind of peculiarly kind of postmodern discourse at times. And it's like, well, how do you deal with that? If you put on live coverage of the Democratic and Republican conventions, you would need a Roman army of fact checkers to keep up with the number of potential misstatements or, you know, partial truths that are being disseminated, and I think that that's an almost impossible task.
For a daily radio show, how about a weekly magazine famous for the most rigorous fact-checking in the land?
I have 16 people in this department, including myself, and at any given point, there are typically 8 or 9 languages that people speak fluently.
Peter Canby oversees fact-checking at The New Yorker.
Mandarin, Arabic, Urdu, Russian, Italian, French, Spanish.
He says New Yorker fact checkers do reporting in reverse.
In other words, we take pieces apart and put them back together again. We talk to the writer's sources. We also try to get to people who were mentioned in the story who maybe the reporter didn't even speak to. If we have a secondhand characterization of somebody else's activities, then we will try to either get the reporter to go to that person or go to that person ourselves just to get their perspective on things.
But what happens if the primary source disagrees vehemently with the characterization or the quote of the reporters? How do you know who to trust?
Well, that's an excellent question. We get notes and transcripts from reporters before we call people. And then if somebody starts trying to back off something they clearly said, then we would say to them, sorry, we're offering you a chance to fix things that are factually wrong and not to rewrite your interview. Naturally, that tends to be kind of a conversation stopper. So when that happens, we would typically go right away to the writer and to the editor, and then we have to iron it out.
Craig Silverman of the Regret the Error blog believes that in the future, the fact-checking of breaking news will make far greater use of the news consumer. In fact, he says that kind of fact-checking has already arrived, performed by NPR's social media dynamo, Andy Carvin.
He has found a way to transform his Twitter feed into an instant newswire about events in the Middle East. And he does that by choosing the right people to follow, by engaging with people on a constant basis, interviewing people and talking to people. One of the other things that he does, he might retweet somebody reporting that bombs have just fallen in one area, and he'll retweet it, but he'll add proof or can you add a photo?
Carvin's interactive process offers the kind of crystalline transparency that Silverman craves. And yet, the very culture of fact-checkers is rooted in invisibility. When a Time magazine editor hired its first fact-checkers back in the 20s, they were exclusively young women.
Because while he considered this fact-checking to be important, it wasn't so important that he would hire men to do it.
He sent a memo around about the ethos of fact-checking. He says, any bright girl who really applies herself to the handling of the checking problem can have a very pleasant time with it and fill the week with happy moments and memorable occasions. The most important thing to remember in checking is that the writer is your natural enemy. He is trying to see how much he can get away with. Remember that when people write letters about mistakes, it is you who will be screeched at.
There's a lot in there. I mean, wow, you know? And what I think is certainly true to this day is that typically people only notice fact checkers if some terrible mistake has been made.
Oh, it's a perilous biz.
Do you have proof that your genitals look like the Virgin Mary?
Can you confirm that you own a red Corolla?
Can you confirm that bootcut jeans are so last year?
Perilous, but not manly. That's the central joke of the Funny or Die web series FCU, Fact Checkers Unit. Hear the daring fact-checking duo pray at the altar of Alex Trebek.
Dear Father of Facts, please give us the strength to conduct this research quickly and properly. Amen.
That old Time magazine editor sure was right about the screeching. The howls over Neil Ferguson's recent Newsweek cover story about the president are still reverberating. Media outlets these days are enthusiastically eating their own and each other, just like they did back in the days of the penny press. And maybe that's a good thing, but it's not for the delicate or the dainty. You can't run, and you certainly can't hide. Not anymore. And now, a fact-checker's nightmare, and also maybe his revenge. In 2002, writer John DeGatta was volunteering at a suicide helpline in Las Vegas when a teenager named Levi Presley jumped to his death from the roof of the Stratosphere Hotel. DeGatta became convinced that he'd talked to Presley before his death. It turned out he hadn't, but it did prompt him to explore the question of why Presley took his life and why Las Vegas has the nation's highest suicide rate. The Believer magazine agreed to publish DeGatta's piece, despite his warning that the essay, more of a meditation really, wasn't altogether factual. No problem. The Believer assigned John DeGatta fact-checker Jim Fingle, and what began as an argument between them over nitpicking became an epic debate over the nature of literary truth. A version of that dialogue was superimposed on DeGatta's original article in a book called The Lifespan of a Fact. The exchange you're about to hear, which we first aired earlier this year, begins with the fact-checker reading this note to self about DeGatta.
In other words, he's manipulating what this guy actually said in order to create a literary effect, which apparently is allowed among writers of John's non-journalistic literary genre, for which he apparently writes all the rules.
I'm not sure how I can say this so that you understand, Jim, because it doesn't seem to be getting across to you. But one more time for the record, I am not a journalist. I'm an essayist. And this is a genre that has existed for a few thousand years. Ever heard of Cicero? So these rules that I'm working under are not mine, but rather were established by writers who recognized the difference between the hard research of journalism and the kind of inquiry of mind that characterizes the essay. And yes, I did it for literary effect, which is also something that essayists do and that journalists don't, or aren't supposed to.
Since I have five more sections to go, maybe you could help me out as I'm still a little foggy on the rules. Basically, it sounds like you're saying that an essayist can write things with arbitrary truth value and make quotations up out of whole cloth that are attributed to real people who live in the real world. Is that right? And if so, isn't that what people call fiction?
Have I changed the meaning of anything here, Jim? No, I've just streamlined this quote in order to help things move along a little better and to create a bit of resonance with neighboring paragraphs. It's what writers do.
Okay, so now I understand. The rules are... there are no rules, just as long as you make it pretty.
That's a bullshit interpretation of what I just said.
I thought you were the great defender of people's right to interpret.
Jim, you seem to have two classes of facts that you're checking. One is simple information, as in how many seconds did it take for Levi Presley to hit the ground? John says 9 seconds. You found out it was 8 seconds. What made that 1 second so important?
It's the job of the editor or whoever is going to publish this to determine what are the tolerance levels for fudging or streamlining. The fact checker's job is to call out even the most insignificant things as incorrect if indeed that's what they are.
John?
The idea that Levi's body had taken 9 seconds to fall from the top of the tower was actually something I received from his parents. And this was long before I had gained access to the coroner's report, which revealed that it was 8 seconds. And so I started researching what 9 means in our culture and in cultures across the world. And so by the time I met the coroner and found out that I was off by a second, the essay had already started structuring itself around 9. Within the essay itself, I actually acknowledge that I got that wrong. And after that moment, the essay, at least I intend for it to fall out of that journalistic mode. And it's signaled by a pretty loud quote from T.S. Eliot, which is that sometimes we misplace knowledge in pursuit of information.
The knowledge resided more in the number 9. Possession is 9/10 of the law. To look 9 ways is to squint. To be dressed to the 9s is to be looking great. To be on cloud 9 is to be feeling high. All these citations of the word 9, they resonated. To remove them would sacrifice knowledge for information. Jim, did you buy that?
You know, the fact checker is not allowed to buy those arguments in terms of what they're doing, and that's what causes the descent into madness.
If you were to have called this an impressionistic essay based on a real event, would that have eliminated the need for a fact checker at all? Is this a problem fundamentally of categories?
It is a problem of categories. When I pick up a medical history, I, at least as a reader, don't expect to have the same experience in that text as I would in someone's memoir. I'm looking for an emotional experience in that memoir, and I really don't care whether that writer needs to change the kind of pie that Aunt B was really well known for from apple to rhubarb, because rhubarb is going to provide me with a fantastic, resonant, emotional experience a few pages into the book. I want that experience.
Okay, so you two eventually have a battle royale over where this process has led you. And John, you give a stem-winding summation of your philosophy on page 108.
Those who embrace the idea of nonfiction are very welcome to it, and I wish them every joy in the world in that pursuit, genuinely. But please don't hold me to parameters for making essays that I've had no say in establishing, that I wholly disagree with, and that I believe misrepresent the true purpose of this genre. An essay is an attempt, Jim, nothing else. And fundamentally, for centuries, that's all it's been. Even etymologically, essay means an attempt. And so as a writer of essays, my interpretation of that charge is that I try to take control of something before it is lost entirely to chaos. That's what I want to be held accountable for as a writer. It's how I want to be judged.
I don't necessarily believe that a nonfiction essay has to strive for an objective account of an occurrence as its primary project, or that the writer is ethically obligated to secure the reality of an event in cultural memory. And I'm all for the POMO, historiographic, metafictional appropriation of events and personages. But there still seems to be something strange about doing this sort of thing with someone like Levi, who is just a teenager, after all, just a kid in Las Vegas. Not a cultural figure or an icon whose life is for the taking and can be radically manipulated and reinterpreted. I mean, clearly it's not like you're defiling his grave by propagating these inaccuracies, but it's kind of like you're being dishonest about where that grave is.
During the process, at any point, John, were you seeking the approval of Jim? And Jim, were you trying to convert John?
You know, I've never told Jim this, but, you know, I secretly think that Jim is about 25 feet smarter than I am. So once we got into this project and started debating, I did want to win, but by win I meant I wanted to try to persuade him, because I figured if I could do that, I might actually be right if someone like Jim could be turned.
To the degree that I wanted to convert John, it was trying to get an agreement on the point of the reader who comes across a text like this and whether or not anyone explicitly leads them to believe it's entirely factual. The way that they're affected by it relies on some sense of authenticity, that something actually happened, and maybe if they see a little bit of themselves in it, they feel a little bit less alone. They perhaps feel more alone when they find out that it was made up or elaborated or streamlined, and maybe there isn't actually someone in the world that's like that.
And yet, in your final concluding note to self, you concede that the truth of anything is a very slippery commodity. Maybe the parents don't remember, maybe the coroner's report is wrong. And you say, which of these sources can we trust as the authority if they've all demonstrated in one way or another the potential of inaccurately representing what actually happened that night? And could you pick it up from there?
Does it even matter? I mean, even if everything that's in question could be verified by unbiased third-party witnesses, and even if I could definitively determine to a fraction of a second exactly when it was that Levi left his house, when he dove off the tower at 6:01 p.m. and 53 seconds and plummeted for a total of 8 seconds onto a sidewalk of brown brick herringbone, well then, I don't know. I'd have done my job. But wouldn't he still be dead?
Jim, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jim Fingal is a software designer. John, thank you too.
Thank you.
John DeGatta teaches creative writing at the University of Iowa. Their book is called The Lifespan of a Fact. Coming up, one man's effort to fact-check fears of the apocalypse. Our future as a species pretty much depends on your listening. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. On February 17th, the wife and two daughters of a Green Beret doctor named Jeffrey McDonald were stabbed. At about 3:40 a.m., emergency dispatchers at Fort Bragg received his 911 call. This is from the miniseries about the killing.
Can I help you?
No. I would need an ambulance.
Yes?
Medics. Medics, hurry.
Military police arrived to find mother and daughters dead and McDonald wounded. He said he'd fallen asleep on the couch and woke to find his home under attack by a group of hippies who chanted, "Acid is groovy, kill the pigs." Prosecutors decided that McDonald had invented that alibi and was himself the murderer. His trial made national headlines and spawned a best-selling book by Joe McGinnis called Fatal Vision. 42 years later, filmmaker and writer Errol Morris has written a revisionist history of the case and its coverage called A Wilderness of Error. Morris is perhaps best known for his 1988 film The Thin Blue Line, in which he delved into the case of a death row inmate named Randall Adams. As a result of Morris's reporting, Adams was exonerated and freed. Morris believes Jeffrey McDonald is also innocent and that, unlikely as his story sounds, the evidence supports it.
The first responder, Ken Micah, an MP who answered this 911 call, on his way to the McDonald house, he sees a woman in a floppy hat standing in a deserted area of the base of Fort Bragg outside of Fayetteville, North Carolina. Arrives at the McDonald house, finds McDonald alive but injured, 3 members of his family brutally murdered, bludgeoned to death. McDonald tells the story of the 4 intruders, 1 African-American male, 2 white men, and a hippie chick with a floppy hat. The minute he hears this description, he thinks, oh my God, that's the woman I saw a couple of blocks away from this house. It's put out on the radio. A narcotics cop in Fayetteville hears the description and says to himself, I know who that is. That's Helena Stokely. That's one of my narcotics informants. And he goes to pick her up. Within a day or so, she starts implicating herself in the crime, telling people that she thinks she might have been there. Ludicrous, ridiculous, unbelievable. But wait one second. Is there evidence to suggest that is what really happened?
Reporter Joe McGinnis mostly dismisses Stokely in his book about the case, Fatal Vision. Meanwhile, McGinnis is allowed to embed with McDonald's defense team because McDonald thought the reporter was on his side. The way McGinnis betrayed his source made people uncomfortable, including Janet Malcolm, whose book, The Journalist and the Murderer, opens with that famous line, "Every journalist who is not too stupid or too full of himself to notice what is going on knows that what he does is morally indefensible."
Yeah, it was bad that he betrayed his subject and never confronted McDonald with the reality of what he was writing. The real crime was he betrayed the facts of the case. He betrayed the truth.
Give some examples.
There was a problem all along coming up with a motive. Here's a guy who went to Princeton, Northwestern Medical School, for all intents and purposes, a loving father and devoted husband. No evidence of any kind of psychopathology. He wasn't the kind of person who would have done this. One of the prosecutors at the very end of the federal trial admitted as much, saying, we don't have to show you that he was the kind of man who could have done it. All we have to do is show you he did do it. Well, I don't believe they did that. And then McGinnis felt he needed to give McDonald a motive. And so he came up with this oddball equation. Diet pills plus psychopathology plus bedwetting equals mass murder. McDonald sued, and in the lawsuit it was revealed a lot of this evidence was stuff that McGinnis just made up. That is a journalistic crime.
And it was that ultimate crime that Janet Malcolm overlooked. In fact, she writes that Jeffrey McDonald would send her from prison mountains of supposedly exonerating evidence. Malcolm said, I don't want this information. The story of the murders has been told by Joe McGinnis, and it has acquired the aura of definitive narrative. Case closed.
I make a comparison between, say, a 19th century miscarriage of justice story, fiction, The Count of Monte Cristo, where a man is imprisoned in what seems to be an impregnable fortress. Here we're talking about a much darker, deeper prison. What if you create a false narrative and the narrative is distributed to tens of millions of people? You write a book, you have a show on 60 Minutes, and then you put out a miniseries starring Carl Malden and Eva Marie Saint as the crusading in-laws who bring Jeffrey McDonald to justice. And here is the narrative prison that Jeffrey McDonald is in. Everybody thinks they know the story. They've seen it. They've seen him killing his family. He must be guilty. The only problem is that the narrative provides a screen from the truth. And here I respectfully disagree with Janet Malcolm. Janet Malcolm, who is someone I vastly admire, I've read almost everything she's written. I respectfully disagree. There is an escape from narrative. Any investigator believes that evidence can lead us out of a narrative prison to the world out there.
How was it that you escaped from this narrative prison?
I can be as much a prisoner to false narrative as anyone else. I'm a persnickety kind of person. Maybe it's the contrarian in me. But I do know that 25 years ago, when I encountered a prisoner in Texas who had been sentenced to death for the murder of a Dallas police officer, he told me he didn't do it. I didn't believe him. Months later, I read the transcript of his trial. There was something about it that wasn't right. Whatever you might think ultimately about Jeffrey McDonald's guilt or innocence, there is something that, to me, is undeniable. The trial was unfair. Evidence was withheld. Evidence was suppressed. A lot of evidence was lost. There was no due process in this trial, and he most certainly, if all of the evidence had been presented to the jury, would never have been convicted of these crimes.
Do you think there's a possibility you might be able to help spring him like you sprang Randall Adams in The Thin Blue Line?
The answer is yes. As we speak, for the first time since the original trial, we're talking over 30 years now, there is a hearing in Wilmington, North Carolina, and the evidence will be presented as a whole. It is my hope that either the judge presiding over this hearing or the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals will overturn the 1979 conviction. If that happens, Jeffrey McDonald will walk out of prison a free man.
Errol, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Errol Morris is the author of A Wilderness of Error. We asked Joe McGinnis, the author of Fatal Vision, for comment, and he gave us the following statement. Jeffrey McDonald was convicted of the murders of his wife and two young daughters in 1979. In all the years since, every court that has considered the case, including the United States Supreme Court, has upheld that verdict in every respect. McDonald is guilty not simply beyond a reasonable doubt, but beyond any doubt. No amount of speculation, conjecture, and innuendo can change that. Here's a fact. According to a recent Reuters poll, about 1 in 10 people worldwide believe that the world may end on December 21st, 2012, an apocalypse that believers claim was predicted in an ancient Mayan calendar. If you are not aware that Christmas is a little iffy this year, don't blame Hollywood because it weighed in with 2012, the movie.
6 months ago, I was made aware of a situation so devastating that at first, I refused to believe it. Through the concerted efforts of our brightest scientists, we have confirmed the world will soon come to an end.
About 30 people a week ask NASA scientist Dr. David Morrison about our imminent annihilation. That's because he's offered himself up as something of a galactic fact checker. And like political fact checkers, he finds that people can be highly resistant to facts they don't like. David, welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure.
So how did a nice NASA scientist like you find yourself in a place like this?
I've always been interested in education, and so about 10 years ago, I started answering questions that the public sent to NASA's Ask an Astrobiologist website. And those were questions about science. Until 5 years ago, when I started getting questions that weren't about science at all, but will the world end on December 21st of 2012? Now it dominates all the questions that I receive and prompted me to do some YouTube videos, and I guess I've become sort of obsessed with it.
Now, a lot of scientists wouldn't bother. Why do you?
Most scientists simply don't know about it.
Oh, come on. Don't they go to the movies?
No. Most scientists don't know about it, or at least they certainly didn't know when I started. And I wouldn't have known about it if I hadn't started getting these questions. Because this doomsday 2012 rumor or hoax has had virtually no coverage in mainstream media, not on NPR, not in the New York Times, not in CNN News. So the people that are obsessed with this, the people who are really afraid of 2012, are getting almost all their information from the internet.
You did research yourself and found out that even the mythical beginning of this notion is wrong, that it isn't in the Mayan calendar.
That's right. The Mayan scholars will tell you that This is just another step in this continuous set of cycles that make up the Mayan calendar, and there's nothing special about it. It's sort of like going from December 31st to January 1st, the cycle just starts again. The same thing's true for the rumors that this comes from the ancient Sumerians in Mesopotamia.
That has to do with the planet Nibiru?
A rogue planet, which, according to these quite fictional interpretations of what the Sumerians thought, comes back every 3,600 years, messes up the solar system, and two times back, brought along its inhabitants who landed on Earth and gave the glories of civilization to Sumer. It's a crazy story. It's an ancient astronaut story. If there were a rogue planet, and some people say it's even much bigger than the Earth, that was going to be here in less than 4 months, it would already be the brightest object in the sky, and its gravity would be affecting the orbits of all the inner planets.
What do they say when you tell them that?
There are people that say, well, it's coming up from below the Earth, and so we can't see it. Now, I think below the Earth is a description that would apply to a flat Earth. On a sphere, you can see the whole sky. They say, oh, there are 100,000 astronomers around the world that are all in the pay of the evil U.S. government to suppress this information, that the government is spraying chemicals into the atmosphere, partly to make us docile and partly so we can't see the incoming object. These are people that truly feel isolated.
So what do you do with that?
My purpose is to try to reach the people who, especially children, who are frightened by this, who don't know any better. And they see that there are literally thousands of websites saying that the world will end, and only two or three that say that that's a hoax.
The position you're in reminds me of the political fact checkers who have not been immune to charges of bias and conspiracy in this election season. Do you relate to them at all?
I think they do a great job. And I realize that some of the political issues are perhaps nuanced and depend a little bit on where you stand. I frankly don't think that one's inability to see an incoming planet Nibiru that's going to crash into the Earth has any such nuance. It's just crazy.
Can you read me a few of the emails that you get?
Nibiru does exist, and I can prove it. Nibiru is in the Old Testament in Exodus. And you, NASA, are watching Nibiru from a telescope in the Southern Hemisphere and can see Nibiru in the daytime. Is that proof enough for you? Or, I'm 11 years old, and I've been hearing from all of my friends that the world is going to end. I can't sleep. I can't eat. I'm scared. I'm thinking about suicide. What can I do? Can you help me? It's very frustrating and very disturbing.
Now, you've made a few YouTube videos.
Some say the Earth's axis is changing. Well, boy, as an astronomer, I can tell you that's not true. If it changed even a tiny bit, our telescopes wouldn't point, our GPS system would fail, airplanes would be crashing. The Earth's tilt is exactly as it should be.
You've agreed to meet the conspiracy theorists and doomsday believers in their natural habitat. Do you think that the internet can be wielded effectively to combat the ideas it seems to be so successful in propagating?
I don't know. I am a little shocked by the number of young people who start from the premise that if it's on the internet, it must be true. And in this case, there are thousands of websites and hundreds of YouTube videos that are manifestly untrue. Some of them are even clever about it. They will take my videos that start with a picture of me and the NASA logo and simply chop that off and put that at the beginning of their video entitled something like NASA Confirms Nibiru and End of World. It's really a jungle out there.
Do you think you are making a difference?
I believe I'm making a difference or I wouldn't be doing this. I have no way of measuring it. The question that comes to my mind is, should the mainstream media also be covering this story? Are they correct to ignore it? Are my scientific colleagues correct to ignore it? Or should we be trying to get out there and help people overcome this dreaded fear that they have of December 21st?
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you.
Dr. David Morrison is the senior scientist at the NASA Astrobiology Institute. And thanks also to Dan Duray, whose piece on the All website introduced us to Dr. Morrison.
You have to begin the evacuation.
All our scientific advances, our fancy machines, the Mayans saw this coming thousands of years ago.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdorovman, Chris Neary, and Doug Anderson, with more help from Lita Martinez and Ariel Stuhlberg, and edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Cambra Moniz Edwards. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts and read our fabulous blog at onthemedia.org. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, and you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield really will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.